At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, sitting with Professor Tyler Anbinder. The book is Plentiful Country, The Great Potato Famine and the Making of Irish New York. The famine Irish have taken the great risk of an ocean voyage to reach to America rather than stay in Ireland where they might starve to death. They are from all parts of Ireland and they're coming to an unknown land. Professor, the trip itself was a test of one's not just endurance and patience, given that you were packed together in steerage or on the deck of a very small ship, but at the same time, you were suddenly prey to all the diseases and that can come to you if you're malnourished. So there was a phenomenon known as the coffin ships. What were those, Tyler?
So the coffin ships, that term refers to ships that came from Ireland to North America during the famine, on which disease spread rapidly and large numbers of the immigrants died before they even made it to America. There were diseases like cholera, which was a waterborne illness, or typhus, which is a disease that you got that was spread by body lice on the ships. And when you're packed in steerage together, you're sharing beds with multiple people, often strangers. And so it was easy to get something like typhus, which was spread by lice jumping from one closely packed body to another. Now, only a tiny fraction of the famine immigrants would have come on coffin ships because there weren't that many of them. And once it became clear what was happening on them, new regulations were put in place to prevent such huge disease on ships. But still, that the story of the coffin ships scarred so many of the potential immigrants and made them very scared to come to America and very fearful that they might die on the voyage. On your typical ship, maybe 1 in 100 passengers would die. And on the typical ship, you had 400 or 500 passengers. But on a coffin ship, it would be, 40 or 50 out of 500 who would die.
Arriving in New York, this is before Castle Garden, which was before Ellis Island. There is no ceremony. They're checked for typhus. I guess that happens while they're still at sea or coming into New York Harbor.
Yes.
And they're greeted by what? There are no officials. Do they have family there? Have they written ahead or are they completely on their own?
They're really completely on their own because it's impossible to know when a ship is going to arrive. There's no schedule. It just arrives when the wind happens to blow them in. And if the wind is particularly fortuitous, you might make it to America in a month. If the wind was average, it would take 5 weeks, but it could take even 6 or 7 weeks. So nobody knew when a ship was going to arrive. So you just got the ship docked on the East River. And people stumbled off, and that was how you started your life in America. That, like you said, there was no inspection other than what you had out in the harbor to make sure you weren't actively sick. But as long as you didn't have a fever at the moment you arrived, you just walked off the ship and began your life in America.
The professor provides an image of New York in 1848, 1849. The winter of 47 was known as the Black 47. So there are people who are coming in late in the late 1840s. New York didn't have towers. It was brick built with church steeples. That's what they saw when they entered New York Harbor. We need to have an example now. Bartholomew O'Donnell, called Bartley, with his mother Mary, with his two sisters, with a baby Cornelius. Bartley needs to pay for his family, and they clearly have you logically deduce they have no money because they go to the old brewery in Five Points. What was that?
So Five Points was the most impoverished neighborhood in New York, and it was predominantly Irish in the period of the Great Famine. And then within the neighborhood, like Five Points, you had your better tenements and your worst tenements. And the very worst tenement in Five Points in this era was known as the Old Brewery. It was called that because it had been a beer brewery until the owners decided they could make more money subdividing it and renting it out as tenement apartments. But because it had been built as an industrial building rather than for housing, many of the apartments had no windows at all and were interior apartments. And so the conditions there were, it was dark, it was dirty. Thieves loved taking their ill-gotten goods into the building because the police were afraid to go in there. And so it was basically the worst tenement in Five Points. And that's, we know, is where Bartholomew O'Donnell and his family moves when they first get to New York. Now, eventually, they move on to other places because the tenement is so bad that reformers buy it from its owner and tear it down to build a Methodist mission.
Bartley, however, has a family to feed and he immediately goes to work. I like that. Day labor. What does that mean in Manhattan in 1848, 1849?
So day labor in New York in that period meant overwhelmingly working on a construction site. Right. So today, all the things that are done by machines on construction sites were mostly done by men with shovels and pickaxes and so forth. And so what Bartholomew O'Donnell would have done on his construction sites are he would have used a pickaxe to dig the holes that made the made the basements and foundations of the tenements and other buildings that he built. Then he would have been in charge of putting bricks and mortar on his back and shoulders and carrying them up rickety ladders up to the masons who would build the brick walls that made up the buildings that were being constructed. And he would do that for one building after another and then move on to another job and another. And it was backbreaking work and you had to do it in the heat and in the cold and in the rain. But nonetheless, that was what the Irish did. That was the number one job for Irish male immigrants when they got to America. And he did that for years.
The professor has obliged us with a chart that shows what work was chosen by the unskilled workers as they left these harried Manhattan shore as they get off the ship. 59% to unskilled workers, 5% to peddlers, 6% to skilled workers, 8% to lower status white collar, 22% to business owners, and 0.4% to professionals. In other words, there was a scale. And what's impressive about all the stories that the professor tells is that everybody had that scale in their minds. They were looking to better themselves and provide for their children who could be even better than they were in terms of this scale from unskilled workers to professionals, doctors and lawyers. Bartley has that in mind. He also goes to Emigrant Savings Bank right away with the first money he has. I take it that is typical. It's in the neighborhood that what you do with money is you don't keep it in under your mattress where it can be stolen during the day. You take it to the bank.
Exactly. That's the kind of thing that a lot of people who look at my book don't understand. They think, oh, well, only rich people would have opened bank accounts. But in fact, it was the opposite because tenement apartments, the tenement building you lived in had no lock on the front door. Your tenement apartment had no lock on the door. So anybody could waltz into your building and into your apartment if you weren't there. And very often for the Irish, everybody was out during the day working. And so as a result, and fire was also such a common threat. And so it's actually the poorest New Yorkers who are more likely to open bank accounts than more well-to-do New Yorkers who could afford to put a safe in their house or could afford to put a lock on their doors or had servants in their house day and night who could make sure no strangers walked in. So that's kind of a myth that I've had to disabuse people of in this book. It's actually the poorer people who are more likely to have bank accounts.
Also arriving in Famine Irish are Dennis and Ellen O'Keefe. Now, this is a wonderful story because it's got a mystery inside of it. They begin in Manhattan, Emigrant Savings Bank, an account, $5, $60, $160 year to year. And then all of a sudden, 1860 arrives, and their account swells to at some point as much, I believe, as $6,000. You have an explanation, Professor. Is it the war? Is it law? Or is it Mr. O'Keefe is clever and somebody tells him about tobacco?
It's really all of those things. So one thing that is not well known about the famine Irish is that, like all immigrants, really, they were very entrepreneurial. They might start out in day labor or jobs like that. Dennis O'Keefe, for example, started out as a porter. He'd be at the train station or the ferry dock. And if you got off and you had luggage or packages to carry, he would carry it for you for a small fee. He starts out that way and supports his family as a porter, but eventually takes his savings and sees during the Civil War that there's a huge shortage of tobacco. New Yorkers, like all Americans, are very addicted to tobacco back then, and yet the supply of tobacco is cut off because of the Civil War. So he goes into the tobacco business. We don't know how he's getting tobacco from the South, but somehow he is, and he sells it at a big markup, and he makes himself a small fortune that way and becomes one of the wealthiest of the emigrant savings bank's depositors. However, another thing that we learned from his story is that, you know, easy come, easy go was sometimes the case for these people, especially if you didn't hedge your bets. And apparently O'Keefe kept his money in tobacco too long. After the Civil War, there was a glut of tobacco back in New York, and he loses his business and has to go back to the more menial kinds of work, not quite being a porter, but doing kind of being a clerk and other kinds of lower white collar jobs. But he had a small fortune during the Civil War. But though he invested some of it in Brooklyn real estate, and so he doesn't end up that badly off, but not quite the wealthy man he was for a couple of years at the height of the war.
Ward One was where I believe that was 5 points in Ward One. We're going to another ward. Ward Four is my guess, but I don't have the map in front of me. Correct me if I got that wrong, Tyler. This is important. To the Bodoni Parish Famine Irish, who lived together in and around the east side of Manhattan. In general, the immigrants who are coming in, and up to nearly a million come into New York in this period of famine Irish, to a New York, and they pass through, they don't all stay, to a New York that was about less than 400,000 beginning this process. Right. One group, the Bodoni Parish from Ireland, settles together and they become vendors. That is a leg up from the day laborer. And they're vending charcoal. Do I remember that correctly?
Correct. And so one of the things we find with the famine Irish and with immigrants throughout New York's history is that networking is a key way in which they gain a foothold in New York. So the Irish immigrants don't just randomly go into one job or another. When they get to America, they find people from their part of Ireland and say, "Where should I live? Can you help me find a job?" And so as a result, people from different parts of Ireland tend to go into different kinds of work. And the people from this one parish of Bodoni, which is in County Tyrone in Northern Ireland, the first immigrants from there have gone into the business of charcoal vending, as you mentioned, or charcoal peddling. And so the immigrants from Bodoni, when they get to New York, more often than not become charcoal peddlers also, until they come to dominate charcoal peddling in the Irish communities of New York. And it turns out it's a very good way to make money. And we can look at the bank accounts of these immigrants, and they save far more, not only than the day laborers, but even more than skilled artisans and more than most Irish New Yorkers, with the exception of people like saloon keepers and policemen. So it turns out that peddling, even though it wasn't a very high status job, was actually very lucrative.
Yes, of the 275,000, the professor's reporting, employed in New York in 1860, 5,000 were peddlers. A twist here, again, you can't make this up. Gold in Bodoni Parish. Gold, which they haven't exploited yet, correct? They're holding off.
Yes, so if you go to that part of County Tyrone today, which I've done, it's gorgeous. It's in the Sperrin Mountains, and so it's just beautiful landscape. But right, in recent years, they've discovered gold under those hills. It's one of the biggest gold finds ever in Europe, worth billions of dollars. Right, the gold hasn't been taken out of the ground yet because there's a fight going on between the corporations that have bought the rights to what's under the hills and the people who live there who don't want their beautiful countryside destroyed in order to take the gold out of the ground. And so it hasn't been bought yet. But since the Irish who were coming from Bodoni to New York didn't own the land there anyway, they didn't give up much by coming to America and finding gold in charcoal peddling rather than staying in Ireland.
Tyler Anbinder, professor, is the author of Plentiful Country, The Great Potato Famine and the Making of Irish New York. We're next going to a man called the Beau Brummel of Manhattan.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.